Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the Caged In podcast, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, as ever, Petros Patsilivas. I thought, seeing as it is Cagey, the first month of the year where we get to celebrate Nicolas Cage for a whole goddamn month, I would resurrect a personal achievement of mine, which was the Caged In Pigcast, which I released throughout July last year, 2021, around the release of the Nicolas Cage vehicle Pig. Fantastic film, directed by today's guest, Michael Zarnowski. It's a big one. I thought I'd resurrect it, seeing as we're celebrating all things Cage, and I got Michael on board to come have a chat with me about how this film came to be, kind of his story of making it, the research that went into it, where this idea came from, and kind of what it's been like since, what it's been like living with this film since July, and kind of having it kind of in the bank for all that time as well. This film was sat on for a year by Neon, and they kind of really wanted to put it out in cinemas, as you'll hear Michael say, as well as hearing some amazing news. Kind of, I think I got it from Michael's mouth as the world got it in their ears that he will be directing the A Quiet Place 3 / like spin-off. And yeah, so check her out. Yeah, hang around to hear that at the near the end of the conversation. But this was a fantastic conversation with Michael Zarnowski, and I very much hope you enjoy it. Before we go into it as well, I think relatively this chat is spoiler free. I would always recommend, though, if you haven't seen the film we're talking about, go check it out. Pig is readily available to buy on all places you buy films. You can buy it on physical media as well as a Blu-ray, which you can see Nicolas Cage in the kitchen with previous guest Chris Zarnecki learning how to cook. So that's always fun. So watch Pig, but I think we avoid spoilers much of a muchness, and just kind of talk about what it's like working with Nick Cage, Alex Wolff, and making this kind of beautiful, poignant film. Again, enjoy this episode with Michael Zarnowski. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Pig's writer, director, Michael Zarnowski. How are you today, Michael?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. As I said to you off mic, and I've kind of said to all my guests, it feels appropriate to be in the setting I am right now. I kind of kind of woodland shack, talking about all things pig.
Yeah, we should have just shot there. That was a perfect setting. We wouldn't have had to build the shack.
I don't know if suburban Crawley is the shooting location that you would
put a green screen outside the door. All of Pig is just green screened. I mean, it's not. We didn't shoot in Portland. We shot on in a studio and just put Portland in the background. Yeah. Man, I loved that shack though. The production designer Tyler Robinson, they built, that was like the one set that we could afford to build. Basically, we pretty much put, I think, all of the production design budget into building his shack, and they really just built like a functional shack in the middle of the woods. It didn't have breakaway walls or anything. It was just this shack in the woods with a garden and a little latrine spot there. And I was so sad that they had to tear it down at the end for insurance purposes. I was like, can't you just like leave it? It was in a state park, but they were like, no, if someone went there and just cut themselves or something, we would get sued for a bunch of money. So I was sad to see that shack go, because they did a really good job with it.
Well, let's kind of talk about the locations, because it seems like the location of Portland and like the kind of surrounding areas, and I know it's kind of hack and cliche to say about a lot of films, but like it feels like a character in itself. So
yeah.
How important for you was it that kind of Portland was at the center of this film?
Pretty important. I mean, that came pretty early on in the screenwriting process. I had never actually been to Portland until after I wrote the first draft, but I just did a ton of research on it. And then once I had a basic draft down, I started taking pretty regular trips up there with Vanessa Block, the producer. And yeah, I mean, the character of Portland is kind of ingrained in every part of it. And then a lot of it came from being there and spending time with the local chefs and spending time just kind of wandering around and meeting people and getting really welcomed into that scene there. Just finding all the ways we could to just bring some of real Portland into it. So there was some baked into the script and a lot of research that went into that. And then just at every turn, you know, we were just kind of trying to bring the soul of Portland out. And it really helped, because like the film scene, the restaurant scene, they all really kind of welcomed us there. Pretty much the entire crew, except for the DP and the assistant director, were all Portland based. Most of the actors were Portland based. So it was, you know, it's sort of the movie naturally had a lot of Portland in it. Mm-hmm. We didn't even really have to try that hard. It just kind of worked out.
Yeah, I know that David Nell said that Darius Pierce is kind of like this Portland legend of the kind of like acting yep. scene there. He's kind of like always putting on like theater productions and stuff like that. And I think he yeah. assumed when he went for the role of Finway, he's like, oh, that's going to Darius. Like, he's the kind of big shot around town.
yeah, no, Darius ended up being Edgar. And yeah, and then David was just an incredible Finway. Yeah, I mean, besides Alex Wolff, Nick Cage, and Adam Arkin, pretty much everyone was a local Portland person. And there's a really vibrant, I mean, they shoot some movies there. They shoot a lot of like TV shows up there. So there is a really vibrant acting scene up there. So it was cool to get to draw from that. I mean, that's really the only place we did any sort of casting call. We auditioned a bunch of local people and found just a great gang, and yeah, everyone really nailed it, which is kind of insane considering, you know, you sit a local Portland actor down across from Nick Cage and ask them to have the confidence to perform like that. That takes a lot of grit for them to pull that off. I mean, like what David pulled off in an 8-minute scene with Nick Cage just sitting across from him at the table, just from a sheer like nervousness standpoint, to be able to act in the face of Nick Cage, like he can be quite intimidating, even though in real life he's very welcoming and encouraging yes. of the process, but like, you know, that's a lot to pull off.
Well, let's talk about that scene, because it's kind of like this, it's really interesting. I spoke to Brett Buckman about this, the editor, and it seems mm-hmm. to be obviously like he's done 3 Nick Cage pictures now with Mandy, Color Out of Space, and this, which I've dubbed the Man of the Woods trilogy. Which kind of like, even if I think, yeah, it's a surprise to Brett as well. But
you should cut all 3 of those together into some sort of fusion film that uses pieces of all of them.
Yeah, perfect. You got H.P. Lovecraft in there, so it could all make sense in its own weird way. Yeah. So, but what I found interesting is like with Mandy and Pig, they both have this kind of key central scene. It kind of like, I'm sure there's probably people out there who've done the analytics to go, that scene isn't central like the scene with Finway, yeah. but it is, it kind of feels at the center of the film. And but what was that day like, and kind of how important was it to nail that scene specifically?
Yeah, that, I mean, it's, you know, when you're on set, we shot this in 20 days, so it was a pretty quick shoot. We didn't have any time for reshoots or anything, so it kind of felt important to nail every scene as we were going along. Yeah. But that one, in some ways, I wouldn't say that one was easier, but it was a really nice scene to film, because I think in the script it was like a 9-page scene, and we filmed the whole scene that day, and we really just kind of got to see it play out. Like, we ran it pretty much beginning to end, like a little stage play. So it was really gratifying to shoot, because you actually felt like you were watching the movie. I mean, you're always, you know, you're trying to capture something real, but you could actually sit back for 9 minutes and just watch this scene play out and have a pretty good sense of it. And it was one of those scenes where, even just watching it on the day, it was like, I'm watching the movie. I like it. It's working. Cool. And so it was very reassuring to have that in the middle of the shoot, as like, because otherwise, you know, you're piecing a lot of stuff together. You're kind of like, yeah, I think this will work. Like, this is, you know, this angle's cool, whatever. But to just like sit back and watch the movie play out before your eyes was really gratifying. And then in the writing process and in the editing process, that scene always, you know, it is a pretty central scene. I know I talked with Brett a lot about kind of the fractal nature of films. He was really into that. And I think that scene is a good example of that, of like a single scene kind of containing the whole in a lot of ways. And it has the humor, it has the absurdity, it has the somberness and the seriousness, it has the sincerity. Like, it sort of has a little bit of every aspect of the film packed into that, and it kind of takes you on this journey through it. So yeah, it was always a really important scene, and it was one of the, I remember on the assembly cut that Brett put together, it was one of the, I mean, he did a great job overall, but it was one of those scenes where when I watched the assembly cut, I was like, yeah, that's working. Like, we didn't really have to do a lot of work on that one in the edit. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool to see.
Well, like, you kind of, mentioned that it's all kind of, I don't know, every scene had to count, but like, as a first-time director, like, what were your expectations going into a film, especially like having someone like Nick on board? And obviously Alex had kind of come off a bit of a hot streak. He's kind of, after Hereditary, was like a, do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, a name to watch. Was there, I don't know, was there like this sense of pressure to you that like, what were your expectations making your first film? It's been crazy.
Yeah, right? I mean, there were definitely moments of pressure. I think you just get so wrapped up in the doing that you don't really have time to feel that much pressure. I mean, you know, you are kind of constantly on edge and constantly having to make these decisions. But I don't know. I think I thought I would have a harder time with that than I did. I'm a sort of quiet, sometimes fearful person. So I was like, oh man, I'm going to be pretty anxious on set. But you know, there are always moments where it feels like things are falling apart. But in those moments, you're having to solve a problem. Like, those are the moments when you have to be most focused. So you kind of just, you don't really have that much time to feel pressured about it. And then early on, when it was kind of before shooting it, when it was more feeling like the pressure of the general idea of, oh my gosh, I'm going to be working with Nick and Alex, and this is kind of a big deal and scary. That quickly fell away once I met Nick and Alex. I mean, they were both just so collaborative and excited about the project, and just seemed like such nice guys that I don't know, it wasn't as much of a problem as I thought it would be. And it ended up just becoming like, hey, we're doing this thing all together, and we're going to give it our best shot, and day to day we're just going to go to set and try to make something cool. And yeah, I don't know, that focus allowed me to not feel too much anxiety about it.
So like, obviously with Nick and Alex, it's one of the things that this film kind of teeters upon is that those two characters and those actors kind of have this chemistry. Like, how kind of, was there a sense of relief when, because obviously it's kind of, you see them now in like interviews and kind of press for the film, and they're like best friends. Was it just like when they kind of clicked, was that like a real weight off your shoulders kind of making this film?
That was huge, because you know, you write the script and you know, there's this element of kind of like a buddy movie with the two of them. So you need that. I mean, it's like writing, you know, a romantic movie. Like you plan around, okay, there's got to be some kind of chemistry there. And thankfully their chemistry was just kind of better than I ever could have hoped. I mean, they just had such an interesting kind of beautiful friendship that developed, that had, you know, a camaraderie, a little bit of competition, a little mentorship, a kind of big brother, little brother, a little bit of coworkers. Like, it just had a lot going on, and they just grew to really care about each other and support each other. And that's the other big thing is, you know, again, it's a young, Alex was 21 when we shot this movie, and he's, you know, acting across from one of his acting idols. I mean, he grew up just wanting to be Nick Cage, and that's a lot of pressure, but Nick was so welcoming and, you know, he's so open to experimentation and open to the craft. Like, he's really an artist and he's a professional. So he made an environment that made Alex feel comfortable to explore, and Alex made an environment that made Nick feel comfortable to explore. So it really ended up being just a beautiful synergy with the two of them.
Perfect. Well, yeah, it feels like we've kind of like dived 2 feet into this. Like, let's kind of back up a bit. And where did this story come from?
Yeah. So initially, the story started with just, I had a little notebook or like a notepad file on my computer where I write down random little, not even story ideas, just snippets of things that I find interesting. And I think years ago, I just wrote down old man in the woods with his truffle pig. And so I was just kind of like, there's that shot where you're kind of tracking through the trees and you see him walking with the pig from the distance. And that was kind of like the image that I had. And I didn't know what the story was, but there was something about that image that I was like, that draws me. Like, I want to explore that. So then it became this kind of thing of unpacking that when I finally decided to kind of dive into writing the script. And it became this real thing of kind of asking questions about that image, trying to figure out, you know, what is this person's backstory? Why are they here? And so a lot of the story stuff developed naturally from that, the location, his profession in the past, what happened to him, why he's in the woods. And then it became, I was sort of at a place in my life where I was, my dad had passed away when I was a kid, and in my late 20s when I wrote this, I was kind of at a place where I could take a step back from that loss and sort of see how it had shaped me and my family. And so that sort of exploration of grief ended up kind of getting baked into the story as well. That's the tidy explanation. I mean, really, it was mostly just me pulling my hair out and trying to figure out how the hell to tell a story and all that stuff. But no, that's looking back, that's kind of the progression that happened.
Perfect. And how did the collaborative process in writing this with Vanessa work? Was it kind of, did you just throw ideas back and forth, or how did that kind of collaboration work?
Yeah, so we had, Vanessa, the producer on Pig, we had a co-story by, and then I was the solo writer. So it was, I would write drafts of it and then send it to her, and, you know, she would give me notes and we would talk about it and brainstorm some stuff. Then I would go off and do another draft. I'm a pretty, like, when I get into my writing mode, I kind of like to shut out the world. I'm sure my friends could tell you that it's a little weird and annoying. I definitely go into like hermit mode. So once I'm kind of doing a draft, I sort of isolate and just go into it. And then I would kind of, you know, come up for air and be like, here's something. What did I do better? and then we would go from there.
Was there ever like a version of this where he wasn't a chef, or was that kind of hard baked in from the start as well?
That was pretty hard baked in. It always, even from the very earliest stuff, it always kind of was this chef film noir like that. That kind of always was the thing. Because the chef thing just came. I mean, just both of those things came very early on from asking questions about that image. Because the question was just, why is this guy out in the woods hunting for truffles?
Yes.
And the answer is because he's, you know, he had a history in the culinary industry. So that just seemed kind of obvious. And then the kind of film noir cowboy come to town stuff came very naturally from, okay, if his pig is taken and he has to track her down and he has to go into the city, that kind of naturally follows some of those classic beats. And so it really became, okay, let's tell a chef cowboy come to town story. Where instead of shooting and stuff like that, he's cooking food for people.
Yeah, that's something that's like beautiful about the film. And one of the things I love about it is obviously when you give people that elevator pitch of what the film is and you kind of say that Nick Cage is attached to it, I know a lot of people I told were like, I don't know what this movie's going to be. Do you know what I mean? They kind of have this expectation of what Nick does. And were you like aware of that when obviously like, you were talking to Nick, or were you kind of put it to one side? Like, I know the movie I'm making here.
Yeah, I mean, kind of both of those things. I was aware of it. And, you know, there was a part of me that was like, are people going to be able to look past this? But then once I sat down with him and talked about the character and the script, I was like, okay, he gets it. He knows the character he needs to play. Who cares about all that other stuff? Like, we know the movie we're making. We know who Rob is. People can bring whatever baggage or assumptions they want to it. But as long as, you know, we just approached it as, you know, we're making this character study and we're trying to make something that's emotionally authentic and explores this character and explores this world, you know, whatever people want to bring to it. I think I was pleasantly surprised that ended up kind of being a feature, not a bug. Like, people were excited by that and pleasantly surprised by that. But, you know, it could have gone the other way. And there definitely were some people who were like, he doesn't beat anyone up in this movie. What's going on here? But, you know, in general, people seemed pleasantly surprised. So that was cool that it went that way. I wasn't sure it was going to, but I kind of had separated myself from it and was just excited by what he was doing and seeing him bring this character to life.
Well, as somebody who's kind of entrenched in the kind of Nick Cage filmography, I enjoy the film as it is, but then I also love this kind of metatextual level you can look at it of the character he's playing, of somebody who's like been, exiled from mainstream society, as it were, and then kind of this film for a lot of people, and it's a bugbear of mine. They say like, is Nick Cage doing something great again? And it's like, oh, no, he's been solidly doing some great stuff throughout that time. But like, I think the readings of it, and the amount of people like, so the trailer dropped, you saw the kind of, it's John Wick with a pig and stuff like that. Was that stuff as well that you were kind of like, again, we know what we've got here, like this stuff will kind of like die in the weeds as the film comes out?
I think the John Wick with a pig perception still lingers, and it doesn't bother me that much, because I kind of knew that was going to be because also the movie kind of knows that that's what it's playing with, because the first half hour of the movie, it's kind of about, the whole movie's about kind of slowly deconstructing that, peeling that away, and then getting down to something more core, character-driven, emotional. So it's baked into the movie to carry you from expecting kind of violence and action and all that stuff to something else. So I wasn't overly worried about it. You know, I was anxious to see like, okay, does the movie do its job as far as carrying you through that? We'll have to wait and see. So it didn't totally surprise me that people saw it that way. But I did like that even when people went in, I read a lot of reviews that were like, you know, I went in expecting John Wick with a pig, and I'm so happy it wasn't that. And in some ways, I think it worked out to the movie's benefit. I'm nervous about everything in the process. I'm always like, oh no, have we made a terrible miscalculation? But overall, I kind of, you know, that worked out well, and I wasn't too worried about it, because I felt like the film carried you through that.
Well, how has the kind of reception to the film been for you? Because obviously, like, as we're talking, not so long ago, Barack Obama put it on his kind of end of year list. It's getting a, almost like a, I don't know, there's, you would think there's kind of like awards chatter about the film, whether it is Nick. I know that like one of the things I noticed when he did the Hollywood Reporter roundtable is like all these other guys, their films are kind of quite fresh. Like Pig came out in July. Do you know what I mean? And it's been interesting to see.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see, because, you know, a lot of the awards movies come out in December. I mean, pretty much all of the movies that are being talked about for the big awards are ones that dropped in the last month. So it's been really sweet to see that somehow Pig is kind of stuck around, because we came out in theaters in July, which is not a Oscar bait sort of time of the year. So it's cool that it hit some sort of nerve and like people are still kind of talking about it. And you know, it's a small movie. We didn't do like a ton of marketing for it, so I think we didn't really expect that this was even an option, but somehow Nick's sort of remained in that conversation. It's mostly been that best actor conversation. And there are a lot of movies this year and a lot of really big movies, but you know, he's really been climbing and people really adore his performance. So it would be awesome if he got a nomination. I think he absolutely deserves it. But yeah, that's also just been a really pleasant surprise. And then I try not to get greedy. Like, I wasn't expecting any of this. And then once you start expecting it, you're like, why couldn't we have gotten that one? And then what about that thing? And like, it's very cool. It's cool to see that like somehow the movie has stayed kind of relevant and interested people. It's been really wonderful.
Well, it felt like the perfect film for the time it came out as well. So like, obviously we're kind of in the height of like the coronavirus and stuff like that. And there's this film that's just so beautifully and poetically kind of plays upon our memories of whether it's like family or like a nice cooked meal or like a lot of people that means family. And yeah, like the kind of the reception, like looking on Twitter and stuff like that, it's amazing how many people reacted to it. Was that like, yeah, how did that feel for you? Do you kind of not tend to look at what people are saying?
No, I look probably more than I should. I mean, initially, I remember Alex Wolf was the one who told me, he was like, just don't read any reviews. And then I think after a few days of getting mostly positive reviews, he was like, you can read the reviews now. Like, I started reading them more. But then inevitably, once you start getting more positive reviews, then I just read the negative reviews because those are the ones that really sink in. But no, I tend to skim most of them. It was really cool to see people respond to it. I mean, it sort of hit at this weirdly specific time that worked well for it. It was, Neon, the distributor, had thankfully they were willing to sit on the film for about a year before releasing it. So we shot it at the end of 2019, finished it in like June 2020, and then Neon was just kind of waiting for a window because they wanted to do a theatrical release. And that kind of came about in July, like right before Delta hit. They really jumped on that like within a few weeks. It was like, this is going to be our window. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. They did it. We had a couple weeks where Delta wasn't too bad yet, and people actually got to go to theaters and see it, and that was cool. And then it's been this kind of consistent process of then people discover it on VOD and then it came out on Hulu in November. And it's been cool to see kind of like the waves of people rediscovering it. And it was very cool. It struck at a perfect time with the pandemic and dealt with a lot of the stuff that people were going through, clearly totally unintentionally. I did not know that there was going to be a global pandemic. It's been pretty surreal. I think because of the pandemic, though, it's also weird because still my life is just kind of like me in my apartment on Zoom meetings. So
yes.
like physically speaking, my life hasn't, in theory, it's changed a lot and it's very exciting, but I'm also kind of, it's a little disorienting because I'm just kind of like, I've made a movie that people really like, but like the world doesn't really exist outside of my apartment anymore. I'm just kind of isolated myself. So it's been a weird time to kind of grapple with what my life is now.
Yeah, I can imagine like this kind of, I don't know, almost like movie like imagining of what you would think like having a hit movie or like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a well-received movie would be like, I don't know, like you get out the back of a limousine and people know you, and then it's kind of like,
yeah, there's gonna be like cocaine or something. Yeah, there's no cocaine. Where's all the cocaine? It was, I mean, we had a great, thankfully we managed to, if my mom is listening, I don't do cocaine. We thankfully got to have like a proper premiere where that was when, you know, it was at this brief moment when like people didn't have to wear masks anymore and things were looking up. Little did we know that was not going to stick around for too long, but you know, we got to have like a premiere in theaters and people came, we had a red carpet and that was cool. And then that was pretty much it. That was like the only major in-person event that we got to really do, but it was really fun still.
Well, yeah, going back to obviously like how it was, like Portland was such a big part of it. I remember David Nell telling me that like he was just about, like when we chatted, was just about to go to a like cast and crew screening like of the kind of Portland natives.
Yeah.
Did you manage to attend that? What was the kind of atmosphere
yeah,
like?
That was probably my favorite screening. So we had the LA premiere, which that one was wonderful because those Nick and Alex were there. My mom and sister flew in and that was really fun. And I got to have my local friends come out. But then the Portland one was really great because that was the day after, I think, Vanessa and I flew up to Portland the morning after the premiere, which was that was fun. And then we got to, there was this like little kind of artsy theater in Portland, and all the local cast and crew came out, and it just sort of felt like a family reunion. Like it was, you know, all the people that we made this movie with getting back together and then getting to share this thing with them where they, you know, they liked it. Like that was exciting to feel like people felt like they worked on something that they really cared about. I mean, they work on plenty of things that they care about, but you know, it was just like a nice thing to be like, hey guys, remember we made this, and hey, it turned out pretty well. It was just like a very warm experience. And also it was just like a reunion because we hadn't seen these people since shooting because of the pandemic mostly. Yeah. I mean, I probably would have gone up there again in between that time if it hadn't been for the pandemic. So yeah, that was a really wonderful screening.
I imagine it's nice to go back to Portland and see that there were like bakeries kind of selling salt bagels, kind of like inspired by
Well, that's the bakery. That's the bakery we shot in.
Amazing.
That was that's Helen Bernhardt Bakery. That is the oldest bakery in Portland, and that's where we shot that final bakery scene. And they sold a shortbread cookie. That was the cookie that he shares with Amir. That's one of their specialties, and it's really good. And then they started selling the salted baguette as well, which I saw the little sign for that, and I thought that was wonderful. They were really sweet. I loved them there.
Yeah, imagine the research for this was a lot of fun, right? Kind of getting used to the...
Yeah, it was all just an excuse to eat a bunch of food around Portland. I mean, those were the early trips. Like when Vanessa and I would go up there to scout locations, half the time it was just us going around to different restaurants, trying meals. And then if we liked the vibe, we would like ask to speak to the chef and then say, I mean, some of this was even before Nick was involved. So it was just these two random people being like, hey, we'd love to shoot a movie at some point here. We'll keep you posted. But you know, the local community really welcomed us, and these restaurant owners were like super generous. Cause we didn't have a huge budget. So a lot of the places we got to shoot were pretty much just from the grace of these places letting us like shoot there. I mean, we could have spent thousands and thousands of dollars that we didn't have to try and get some of these locations, but most of them were just like excited to help out this kind of small film. And it was very cool.
Amazing. So how did Nick get involved on the project?
So he, after Mandy, he had just moved over to WME agency, and so they were looking for some new projects for him, and we had Endeavor Content, who's kind of that and WME are like an entity kind of. Endeavor Content handles more of the production stuff and foreign sales and all that. And they had become interested in Pig, and they became real champions of the project. And it was sitting down with them and meeting with Endeavor Content and WME that that they suggested Nick. They just kind of threw him out there, and we hadn't even considered him. And it was kind of just one of those, like, do you think he would want to do this? Is this the kind of movie he would want to do? And they were kind of like, let's see what he thinks. So they sent him the script, and he very quickly was like, this is absolutely the kind of movie I want to do. It was surprisingly easy, I guess is the answer. WME was looking for new stuff for him. He was excited to try something different. And I think it just hit at a perfect time. It was pretty surreal.
What was that first meeting like with Nick? Cause I know that he said that, in that, Hollywood Reporter roundtable that he ended up explaining to you like a dream he had or something like that.
About his cat Merlin. that first meeting was, we got like brunch together downtown, and I mean, it was both amazing and also pretty straightforward. Like, I gave him a comic book and we sat down and we chatted about the script, and it was kind of quickly like clear that we were both on the same page with the script. So then we just kind of started shooting the shit and talking about pets and love of food and Italian heritage and all that kind of stuff, and just kind of enjoying the food. It was quickly apparent that we know what we're doing, we're on the same page, this sounds good. It was surprisingly low stress.
Other directors I've spoke to who've worked with Nick always say that like he kind of, when he comes to a project, kind of he just has the script learnt backwards, forwards, kind of.
Oh my God.
Knows everything. I mean,
he knew it better than I did. Like not just his dialogue lines, he knows the action lines, like word for word. Like I, it's pretty incredible. I don't know how he, I mean, I guess he's been doing it for a long time, so he's very practiced in it, but I was very impressed with that. I mean, he's, you know, you think of Nick as this rock star, and he is, but he's, you know, he's an artist and he's extremely professional. Like, mm-hmm. if you're going to get to the point he's at in his career and do the number of movies he's done, like, he knows how to operate on set. He knows how to be respectful to people. He cares about what everyone's doing. He knows that all of these jobs on set are super important. I mean, he was just a pro on set. I mean, he was so kind to everyone, always early, always down to sort of go the extra mile on things. I think people assume that he's probably like bonkers on set and hard to work with, but it was the total opposite.
Well, you know, as I said, everyone I've had the good fortune to speak to have said, like, comes with not only just knowing the script, he kind of has like these notes and kind of like, well, kind of, he knows the character himself and it.
Yeah.
And what's really heartening about it as well, it's speaking to people who their budget for their movie is $3-5 million, and he's still giving that same level of respect on that than he would, than I imagine he would, do you know what I mean, doing a Jerry Bruckheimer movie for Disney or whatever. So yeah, it's really heartening to hear that. And I know that, is it true that he took everyone to see Parasite whilst you were filming the movie?
Not, there was like a small group of us that all went to see Parasite. And that was, that was like, I think the weekend before we started shooting, or maybe it was a week into it. I can't remember, but yeah, there's a little theater, in Portland and we went there and watched it. That was pretty cool to be in a theater. There's like six of us just sitting in a row together. And that was really fun.
A nice level of kismet as well, right? That Neon eventually released.
Yeah, I know
that was,
it came full circle. And it's a great film, so it's always good to watch an inspiring movie going into something. But working with Nick was wonderful. Everyone was, mm-hmm. you know, this was a small movie. It's a weird movie. If it kind of filtered out for good people that cared about it, because no one's going to sign up for this movie if they don't love it, because they know there's not a ton of money in it and they know it's pretty specific and strange. So the people that wanted to do it really cared about it and saw something that moved them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like just in general, we had a nice tight-knit family on set. It was very, very gratifying.
Yeah, as somebody who's like a massive champion of the film, I remember like as it was coming out, because I was fortunate enough to get a screener from Neon, but like even when it was coming out in cinemas, I was like going like, trying to find the nearest place to go see it, went and saw it. Yeah. And I don't know why I took it upon myself to kind of like just tweet out everywhere kind of in the UK. you could go check it out, because there's a lot of people going, my local place isn't showing this. I'm like, whereabouts do you live? Like, did it, aww, like,
thank you. You were our UK marketing team. No, we actually did have a UK marketing team, but thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Altitude, I owe me. I'll send an invoice to Altitude. there's just a couple of more things I wanted to touch upon before I let you go, Michael. One of them is, I know, I'm not sure how true this is, but like, it's kind of written out there that the original length for this film was a bit longer. Was it your intention to have a longer film, or kind of this tight 94 minutes?
I think that's kind of a misconception. I know where that comes from. It's just, I think what people are saying when they say that is the assembly cut was like probably like 2 hours and 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But that's like, there was no kind of functional cut of the film that was that long. That was just the assembly cut, is kind of where you just dump everything in, and it's, you know, it's tons of stuff that you know you're going to cut out, but you kind of just want to have it all in there to see how it plays, and then you sort of trim it down from there. So and even that wasn't crazy. I mean, there are assembly cuts that are like 4 hours long. You know, 2 hours and 20 minutes isn't that crazy for an assembly cut. So we really, you know, we cut like probably 45-50 minutes out of that, but it was all stuff that needed to go. I mean, honestly, you know, there are a couple little scenes that I wouldn't mind that, you know, we trimmed down for pacing, but I wouldn't have minded bringing back, but mm-hmm. I don't think they would amount to more than like 2 minutes or something.
Yeah. That classic director's cut with six minutes extra, and every scene's got a couple of seconds added back on.
Yeah.
Perfect. So You obviously touched upon Nick and Alex getting on really well, but when it comes to like working with actors, do you tend to give them other films or kind of materials to look at to kind of, this is the tone or the vibe we're going for with this film? And what was that on Pig?
A little bit. I mean, I think my biggest form of directing is the writing. Like, I think it was, the script was pretty specific about the tone and the vibe of certain things. So, mm-hmm. So I think that was most of the battle. There were a couple little things. Like, I remember, it was, you know, I sent Nick some books. There was that, I still don't know if he's read that comic book, but that I gave him this graphic novel, Asterios Polyp, that I think had some elements to it. And then I gave him a copy of Devil in the Kitchen, Marco Pierre White's book. Mm-hmm. Cause there's a lot of Marco Pierre White in this movie. He was this chef that, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he still is a chef, but he was this three Michelin starred chef that gave up all of his Michelin stars because he was just kind of done with the industry and went and like lived with his family in like a home out in the country. So there, he was very inspiring for this. So I gave him some of that. I mean, like movie references. I had a couple things that I think I talked with Alex Wolf a little bit about a couple movie references, just not even really for his performance, more just he was kind of curious, I think. And there was a movie called Revanche that I think is Austrian movie. I think it's an Austrian movie that was kind of inspiring for Pig. So I remember he watched that and really loved it. But it was just such a specific tone that really the best way to get it across was through the script. So that there wasn't a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you could kind of be like, there's like a little Coen-y, it's a little Jarmusch-y sometimes. It's a like there wasn't anything cleanly enough, like this is what it is. So
yeah.
Mostly it was just kind of the script and then having just conversations with them.
I think that's what's quite beautiful about the film is I know it's very easy to sell films, and I guess it's laziness on the part of movie fans a lot of the time. It's X meets X and you get this movie, and a lot of what's, I don't know, you could be lazy and do that with Pig, but it doesn't do the film, I don't think, justice to be like, it's, I don't know, it's John Wick meets Ratatouille, like, which,
both great movies.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of that credit goes to, you know, the producers and financiers who were willing to, you know, to do this movie off of, I hadn't done a movie before. And I never really had to pitch it. Like, usually it was a short script. It was only 84 pages. So I would send it out. People would read it and they would either love it or not, or just be like, what is this? Leave me alone. So I rarely had to sit down and say like, so it's this, there's this pig and he's like, I didn't really have to do that for some reason. Somehow I managed to avoid that. it was very cool that they just kind of had faith in it off the script and that we executed, hopefully.
Well, mentioning the pig, how was it directing a pig on your first film? They say never work with children and animals.
I did both. I did pig and children and a lot of driving. I would say you don't really direct a pig. You just kind of hope for the best. Because we couldn't afford a trained acting pig. So Vanessa and I just drove around to different pig farms outside of Portland and just found the pig that had the best look and personality. And her name was Brandy. She was a Cooney Cooney pig. And she was a very sweet pig and very beautiful. She had very soulful eyes. But we had an animal trainer work with her for like a week, but that was not enough time to like really do that much with her. Cause I think a big part of it is just getting animals prepared to perform on set when there's a lot of noises and lights and movement happening. And that was just overwhelming for her. So mostly it was just about being quiet and kind of calm when she was around and just trying our best to like get her to look at a certain spot. And we'd just be like clapping off camera and that sort of stuff or sneaking food in spots. And then the other useful thing was just having Nick feed her a lot. So she just kind of knew, okay, if I go to him, he'll feed me. So a lot of us just, you know, holding her off camera. And then when he comes in, you just release her and she's like, oh boy, I'm going to go to the guy who gives me food. So, you know, it's just kind of figuring it out as, you know, you have to, suddenly try to get into a pig's psyche as you're trying to make a movie. There's so many weird little jobs with directing to figure out.
It was definitely a stroke of genius, whoever came up with the idea to give Brandy a character poster for the film. I remember when that came out, yeah. I was like, this is a real, pun intended, chef's kiss of a kind of marketing move. As we start to wrap things up, I'm not sure if you did this intentionally, but did you know that you kind of have added to the tradition of Nicolas Cage stealing bikes in movies?
No, I didn't even know that was a tradition. This is new. I haven't even heard this.
So there's The Rock. He steals a motorbike off of somebody. There's the Wicker Man, where he like commandeers a bike off of one of the islanders. And now there's Pig. Obviously, he kind of gives a guttural scream at somebody.
Was Wicker Man a bicycle or a motorbike?
A bicycle. Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of any two.
A bicycle?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I did not know that.
So
that's amazing. I'm honored to be a part of that tradition. Yeah, the bike was actually a budget choice, because initially there was a scene where he rides the light rail there, mm-hmm. and the ticket taker was supposed to ask for a ticket, and there was this like mini altercation, but we just couldn't afford to shoot on the light rail. So I was like, I'll just stealing a bike kind of accomplishes the same thing. Yeah. So we did that.
I like that it's kind of, I don't know, out there in the ether, like that happens by mistake, and it kind of creates this tradition, because there was the Sion Sono film that Cage did that came out last year. It feels like something that feels like it's referencing that, but probably isn't. His character is given the choice of a sports car, like to go accomplish his mission, and he takes a child's like bike instead. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like there's this kind of running theme throughout Nicolas Cage's career where he's always commandeering bikes to
you gotta write a book on, because you see all the patterns that everyone else doesn't see, because they haven't seen all these movies to make these connections. You see the Matrix, man.
It's like a beautiful mind up in here.
The other side of this shack is just filled with like red thread and photographs and pictures of bikes and your conspiracy Nick Cage wall.
Yeah, I am definitely Charlie Day in that episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Oh, yeah. Cigarette on the go, kind of. Yeah, there's bikes. There's Cage.
The bike.
Before I let you go, what's next for you, Michael? Imagine like is you said you're just in your apartment. The Hollywood lifestyle isn't as you expected it, but yeah, what have you got on your plate next?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few things I'm working on that I'm really excited about. Actually, just today, literally while we're on this podcast, I just got a bunch of texts. I guess it came out that I'm going to be writing and directing the Quiet Place spinoff, like John Krasinski's Quiet Place movies. They're doing another movie in that universe. And that just sort of came out of nowhere at the end of the year.
Amazing.
And John was just so wonderful. And we've been kind of throwing ideas around. And so that's cool. I guess I'm allowed to talk about that now. I mean, I think that's probably all I'm allowed to say. But
amazing.
I hope I was allowed to say what I just said. But that's one thing. That's one thing that's happening. But I have a few other things that I'm working on. Just trying not to get cripplingly overwhelmed and yeah. I tend to be a fearful person, like I said. So my initial instinct whenever I get some sort of offer is like, no, I shouldn't do that. I can't do that. That's a bad idea. I'm afraid. I won't be able to do a good job. So I'm trying to not listen to the little insecure voice in my head and just enjoy making cool stuff.
Well, yeah, I imagine there's a thing that you see a lot of directors kind of direct something really interesting and personal for their first film, and then they kind of get swallowed up into the Hollywood system somewhat in kind of, I don't know, in
I'm trying to avoid that. I mean, that's what I liked about this Quiet Place thing, was that they seem super open to doing something kind of unexpected and different with it. So that was really refreshing to be like, oh, you're saying I could do something in that realm, but okay, I that's all I shouldn't even be saying. I don't know what I should be saying about this, but I was excited that it didn't feel like a studio system swallowing me up.
I know what you mean. I know that you spoke on the Movies That Made Us podcast and about Logan and how obviously James Mangold kind of got to make a James Mangold movie, or kind of a movie that isn't kind of a part of this structural thing and didn't have to slot into too much of this stuff. And yeah, it's nice to know that's hopefully where it's going with this Quiet Place movie.
Yeah.
That's amazing news, man.
Thanks, man.
Well, Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much. Before I let you go, as I ask all my guests, I must ask you, which is your favorite Nicolas Cage film? I know you've got a horse in the race, but Pig's Discounted.
Besides Pig, I won't include Pig. Only one, or could I say like a few?
You can have some honorable mentions. Yeah, we can.
Okay, let's go with one. I mean, there are so many I love, but one that is a special one for me is I really liked Moonstruck. I hadn't seen that, and I watched it right before we shot Pig because I was kind of trying to catch up on ones I hadn't seen. And I don't know. I'm half Italian, and my family moved out to Wisconsin when I was a kid, so I never really got to see that like East Coast Italian family and be a part of that world. Like there were a couple times where we would go out and visit and have these big Italian dinners, and I was like, wow, I've really missed out on something. And I remember watching Moonstruck, and it was just kind of like a fairy tale of what my life might have been if I had been around more of my Italian family. So that was very special, and he was just amazing in it. So that one holds a special place in my heart, but there's tons of really good ones.
Yeah, I always find 1987's a really interesting year for Nicolas Cage's career because it's Moonstruck, Raising Arizona, and I know he shot Vampire's Kiss like that time, wow, but didn't get released till like a year or two later. But like,
that's crazy. What a year.
Yeah, it kind of gives you every kind of stroke of what Cage can do, right? It's kind of the nexus point of the rest of his career.
Yeah, that's very true. Man, you got to write this Nick Cage book. You got to write.
I don't know. There's a lot of Nick Cage books out there. I just got to find my angle. that's an absolute. That's a lovely sentiment.
What is your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
It kind of fluctuates. I'm like, I have a lot of recency bias. So I recently watched Red Rock West again, which is a John Dahl neo noir from 1993, starring Cage, Laura Flynn Boyle, and Dennis Hopper, and JT Walsh. And it's, if you haven't seen it, it's kind of...
I haven't seen it. Oh, I gotta watch
it. Yeah, it feels like a movie that wouldn't be made today, and like, I don't know, everyone's firing on all cylinders. It's just, it's perfect. It works as an old school noir, but it's kind of got this Wyoming setting, but feels like a Western vibe to it, and it's fantastic.
Right up my alley.
It feels like it would make, I think, a good double bill with Pig, kind of this Red Rock West is more about a man who gets in over his head in kind of a situation. It's that perfect thing of, I guess the way to liken it is the way that Breaking Bad did that thing where every episode you're like, how the hell are these characters going to get out of this situation?
Yeah.
It's like Red Rock West is that for 90 minutes, just like Cage's character kind of things get progressively worse and worse. Yeah. And then
I was thinking about that with Breaking Bad. It's like the whole show is basically just you being like, well, that's it for these characters.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They're just screwed. Like,
yeah.
There's no way out of this.
Yeah. It's how they're going to get out of this one. You almost like want to kind of freeze frame but Red Rock West is that. And then half hour, 45 minutes into the movie, the late great Dennis Hopper gets thrown into the mix and things get wild. So yeah. So
I gotta watch this. This is my next movie.
Perfect. Well, Michael,
thank you for the recommendation.
No, thank you for coming and chatting about this film. This has been
of course a
bucket list chat to tick off the list. So thank you so much.
Thank
for coming.
You for having me. It was such a pleasure.
And there we have it, guy. A lovely Michael Zarnowski. And what an absolute, I don't know, mind-blowing turn of events for me. You can probably hear it in my voice in that chat that kind of, as he mentions about the Quiet Place thing, and it's kind of like, there was a moment where I was like, is this a scoop? Have I got like have I been told this early? And I don't know. Yeah, I loved that conversation. I very much hope you enjoyed listening to it. Again, Michael, if you're listening, thank you so much for that. It was an absolute peach of an episode. I very much enjoyed it. If you enjoyed this one, please do go back and listen to some of the conversations that are mentioned in this, or just all of the conversations in the Pigcast series. So that is Brett Buckman. You can go back and find that. We talk not just about Pig, but about Colour Out of Space and Mandy as well. There's Vanessa Block, the co-story writer of this film and producer, who has some amazing stuff. We kind of touch upon the kind of the female spirit that runs through this film, and kind of yeah, there may not be many females on screen, but they were very, very, very well, they found it important to make sure that there were women behind the scenes. A lot of department heads were female, and there was a lot of female crew. And so we talk about the kind of, I don't know, the female heart beating at the center of this story. There is Chris Zarnecki, the chef, who taught Nicolas Cage how to look like a chef. That's a really fascinating, interesting conversation. There is Philip Klein and Alexis Grapsas talking about the music for Pig, which again, is a fantastic, fascinating, if not awkward conversation, but that is entirely my fault. There's the fantastic David Nell interview as well. As we touched upon in this episode, he had that one killer scene with Nicolas Cage and Alex Wolff playing Chef Finway. And if you've seen the film, you know how deliciously vital and great that scene is. So that was a fantastic chat. And then my kind of deep dive into the film itself, where I was joined by Andrew Pope to talk all about Pig, all things Pig, in a regular Caged In episode. So do be sure to check all of that out. As for next week on the podcast, I will be joined by writer, comedian, musician Jordan Gray to talk about the 2005 Nicolas Cage arms dealer thriller drama Lord of War. I'm really looking forward to talking about this film again, because one, I think it's a great film, and it's it makes me think, oh, I'd love to see Ethan Hawke and Nicolas Cage star in something together. This is very much a film of cat and mouse, so they get a lot of screen time together. But yeah, those two head to head would be fantastic, or kind of side by side, should I say, as kind of co-leads in something, would be amazing. And get to kind of maybe stick the boot to Jared Leto a bit in one of his probably early films, where he's doing an atrocious accent. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode of the podcast, please do be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Spotify, wherever you are listening, and give us a brand spanking 5 stars. That little rating and review, that would be fantastic. I know every podcast says it, but it really does help to get this podcast in more people's ears. Shoot us up the charts, and kind of, as I always say, this could be somebody's favorite podcast. If they're kind of Cage curious, they're Coppola curious, or they're just a bit of a film head, or kind of, I don't know. Yeah, if you enjoy this podcast, I'm sure someone else will as well. So do be sure to spread the word. If you'd like to have a bit more of a serious commitment to the podcast and part with some cash, you can head on over to ko-fi.com/cagedinpod to buy me a little digital cup of coffee, which helps keep the lights on over here at Caged In Towers. Or you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where this week, this Thursday, we have the first ever episode being released of the brand new exclusive Patreon series Movie Brat Bros, which is kicking off with its first season, De Palma-rama, where we are looking at the films of Brian De Palma and how they relate to the filmography of Francis Ford Coppola. So, for instance, 1996, Mission Impossible came out. Also in 1996, for Francis Ford Coppola, Jack came out. Who had the better year? Well, listen to the podcast to find out. But we'll be kicking off this Thursday, looking at the 1974 Brian De Palma musical comedy drama, absolute kind of, I don't know, gonzo work of art that is Phantom of the Paradise, where I will be joined by Jeanette and Daryl Bear, and it is an absolute hoot. So be sure to head on over to Patreon and chuck a little £2.50 or $3 in the bucket to get access to that episode and many more to come. So as always, guys, I have been Petros Patsilivas. I have been caged in. You have been amazing, and I'll catch you next week. Here's a little treat for you guys who listen right to the end. Before me and Michael really got into the conversation, kind of a little pre-record, we had a little chat, and I kind of hit record on my recorder just because I found the conversation we were having to be really interesting. I'm sure Michael won't mind me sharing this. We kind of talk about Nick Cage, and he's kind of flabbergasted at the fact that I've seen every single Nick Cage movie. So yeah, here's a little bonus treat for you guys who listened right to the end. Enjoy.
The morning before we shot, so the mushrooms that Nick is cooking in the movie are actually just mushrooms they like found in the woods.
Amazing.
And then after Nick had diced everything up and it had just been sort of prop stuff, he took it and just like cooked up this incredible mushroom risotto just with the leftovers and just fed it to the crew at like in the middle of the night when it was cold out in the woods. And yeah, he was wonderful.
Yeah, I think Chris said like one of the takes that, or like, yeah, when he saw Nick cutting at one point, he was kind of doing it a bit like too wild. And he's like, oh, he hasn't listened to what I told him, and then saw the film. And he's like, oh no, he knew exactly what he was doing. He kind of,
I was very nervous all the time about Nick. Cause he also was using, the scariest thing was he's using a mandolin, like the thing to slice the potatoes and those, it's like very easy to cut the tip of your finger off. So I was constantly worried that we were just going to like have to take a week off because Nick was going to just slice his finger off. But yeah, he managed to not hurt himself, which was great. And yeah, he really, I mean, I think with, and we don't have to get into all this now, but I think Nick just, you know, it's impossible in a week to suddenly become a professional chef, like to look like that. But I think what Nick did was he learned the basics, and then he just put so much like care into what he was doing on screen with the food that you just kind of felt like he loved the food and got it. So it didn't really matter if, like, you know, he couldn't chop as fast as a normal chef or whatever. Like you just felt like this guy loved what he was doing, and you could just feel it through his hand.
Well, I think that's one of the joys of Nicolas Cage on screen, right? Is that like, I often, having watched all of his films and kind of talk to people.
Have you seen all of every single Nick Cage film ever?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I guess you would have to with the Caged In podcast, but that's incredible.
Yeah.
How many are there total? What's he at? Like 100?
Close to like 97, I think, with like stuff that's kind of on his slate. And it was kind of that interesting thing to see like the pandemic slow him down slightly. But then as soon as the kind of shooting started again, it's like he's got 3 or 4 films like due out.
I don't know if the pandemic slowed him down that much. I think he still shot like 5 movies last year. He has endless energy.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.